Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Texas, when you say your name, like I'm Raleigh, I'm an alcoholic, they don't say, hey, Raleigh. They just kind of like, they don't say anything. They just kind of go to the next person. Well, the first time I'm like, hey, Bob. And then they're like, we don't say that. And I'm like, I got it. And I mean, like 7 or 8 times. And the first time you're like, really nice. If you're out of town, I understand, you know, you come into a new facility or a new AA meeting. It's very similar, but sometimes there's pieces that are a little bit different and the nuances. And of course, you know, I had that embarrassment and I felt uncomfortable and I couldn't believe I said that. It reminded me a lot of my first couple of meetings in AA. You know, I was uncomfortable. I was embarrassed. I didn't know what to say. I didn't feel like I belonged. But it was a lot worse when I was new. And if you're new tonight, I want you to know I relate. I've been there with you. Nobody comes here with 17 years sober. We all come here with one day. And a day at a time, we learn how to live without alcohol. But see, that wasn't my first time I ever came to Alcoholics Anonymous. First time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was in 1991. I was part of a treatment center. I was in a psychiatric hospital. I think it sounds a little more, you know, macho, I guess. I don't know, psych ward, you know. Most people in here, somebody thought the psych ward experience doesn't make me an alcoholic, okay? But, you know, if you're new tonight, you're sitting in here, you're going to hear my story. You may relate, you may not relate. But what I'd want to try to do the best of my ability and the time they gave me today is really speak to the newer people. Because when I was, everyone I give a speech, my sponsor is Tim Marr. He lives on Hinsdale, and so I end up in Hinsdale every Thursday night. Otherwise, it's like half a mile beyond any links. When you live downtown and you try to get out there, but he's my sponsor for a reason. And one of those reasons is he's one, not afraid to hurt my feelings. Two, he tells me the truth that I need to hear, not the truth I want to hear. And three, he's busier than I am in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I need somebody that's busier than me. But it's important that in the time that I have that I speak to the new person generally, because what he told me when I was new and what I learned when I was new is if you have people have less time than you, they may listen. If you try to speak to people that are your peers, you're going to wonder why they're not speaking. And if you have more time than me, like the last gentleman shared, he's like, what could you possibly tell me? You only have 17 years. You know, whatever I say will be, well, that's what I thought. When I had 17 years, wait till you have 22 years, and then we'll talk to you, you know. And so there's always a continuum here of experience. But one of the things I do want to touch on before we get into it, too, is one of the things in AA that I didn't understand, because I came in here as a Marine, and I understood time and grade, I understood rank structure, I knew the longer you were in something, the more that you get, more rank, as long as you did well. It's not like that here. This is not a linear program. It's not like 6 months you'll feel like this, a year you'll feel like this, 5 years you'll feel like this. It's a transformational program. There's people that I'll listen to that have 9 months, and I want what they have, and there's people I listen to that have my time, and I don't want anything to have. Because this isn't about, if you're new, this is what a part of what I talk about. You're in Alcoholics Anonymous right now, but this is not Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I didn't understand the difference. I thought because I got on drunk and attended some meetings that I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. No, I'm just visiting. And I didn't understand the difference when I was new. I thought I'm going to meetings. This is what you do to get sober. You stop drinking, go to meetings, and people talk at you, you know? And then somehow I don't drink until the next meeting and you guys get together and talk about how bad it was. And then we can remember when we talk to each other how bad it was so we don't go and drink again. And there's a lot of things that I heard some misinformation even back in 1991. I'm sure there was good speakers and they were, but I didn't hear that. What I heard is alcohol is your problem. Stop drinking alcohol. Your life's going to get better. And see, that was not my experience. See, I was born needing a drink of Alcoholics Anonymous. At some point in the, maybe not born, but at some point in the upbringing that I had, I needed a drink long before I got one. The first drink I got when I was 15 years old, but I needed some kind of an answer. Now, I don't know why I needed an answer. Now, mine was because I thought I had an alcoholic father. It was an abusive home. You know, my parents were divorced. We lived in a small town. I had a hard time socially. I couldn't seem to fit in with other people. I was an overweight kid. My teeth were all messed up. It was a very small town and people were not really nice. And I had a gay uncle. And so all these things were going on in this little tiny town that I thought made me feel different. And I could never feel as good as you. So I always tried to overperform. I had to be twice as good to feel half as well. You know, I could never feel like you. And that was from the time that I was young till I knew. And because of some of the abuse and the things I had gone through, they started me in psychiatric care when I was 8 years old. and I don't really want to get into that. But they started me that a long time ago. And along the way, I had all kinds of coping mechanisms I found out. Fantasy, reading, even performing. I played sports, you know. I love playing sports because I got some kind of accomplishment from it. I found music, which kept me alive. I played trumpet, and nailing a trumpet solo gave me a feeling of satisfaction for just a minute. I loved to write. I was a good writer. All these things came together, and I thought they would a little bit, but they wore off so quick. And so I needed to find something, but I was not going to drink because my old man drank, and I didn't want to be like him. I knew what happened when you drank. I saw the destruction that I watched him tear a career as an architect down upon him. I watched what it was like when I was a kid. We had a shell of a life that everyone came to our house for parties, and yet there was no money for toys. There's no money for foods. My mom had to work at like a local restaurant. But we were the society family that everybody wanted to come and see, but it was just how we looked. It wasn't how we were. And I didn't want to be like that. I watched that man lose everything and then come take the keys from the house and kick us out. So I knew what alcoholism looked like. I wasn't going to drink, but I started doing other things. I started cutting on myself when I was a kid. My body will carry scars till the day I die from that. I needed some relief a long time before I had a drink of alcohol. But see, I didn't know what alcohol did for me. So when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1991, it was because I'd gone into one of these psychiatric hospitals. And I just want to explain to you, if you're new to everything I said up to this point, does not make me alcoholic. None of that. You can take it in a file cabinet and push it away. If you don't relate to it, it doesn't matter at all. What matters is when I was 17 years old, or 16 years old, I came out of that psychiatric hospital, and I went back to that small town where 7,999 of the inhabitants had not gone to the psychiatric hospital. But one little boy had, and that was me. And I was terrified that someone was going to say something because it was already about to come apart in a million pieces. And I had not found any real relief, but I liked the psychiatric hospital because they had levels, and levels are great. If you're in some kind of an inpatient, level one, can't have shoelaces, level two, you get your shoelaces, level three, you don't have to do 15-minute checks to see if you're killing stuff, and level four, you get two desserts. I mean, it's like, you're in. Level four is good. And so they would rate us one to four, and you could keep your status, and everything was great until I got back to Franklin, and no one cared that I was a level four patient. They weren't like, oh, congratulations. They're like, there's the crazy kid, you know? And who wants to be the crazy kid? And so I got invited to one of these sports parties, kind of a legacy holdover to what I did before, and I went to it. And I remember I was down in the basement. It was kind of a basement like this. It was a nice home. They had a ping pong table set up over here. And they kind of had a beer refrigerator. And the cool kids were upstairs. And they were playing together and they're doing whatever cool kids did. I didn't know, but I guessed at it. Okay? But I was down there playing ping pong because I picked up the skills in the psych ward. Ping pong, and I feel like I'm doing pretty well, you know, and I'm just hoping nobody says anything to me. And then the love of my life came down the stairs, Ashley McNeil, you know, and she walks down. I remember like yesterday, she walks down these little stairs and she looks right at me. She goes, "Raleigh?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And she goes, "Do you have any money for beer?" And I was like,
"I'm sorry, Christina. I'm afraid I don't have an answer to that."
That's not what she said. What she said, what I said was, "Yes, actually, I have money for beer." And so I gave her some money for the beer, which would be a theme in my life when I started drinking, which is a woman asked me for money, and I gave her money so that we could potentially become friends, you know? And so I did this, and she went away, and I was, like, devastated because she's just using me like everybody else in my life was using me, you know, the drama, you know. And then, you know, so she comes back downstairs a little bit later. She's like, "Hey, Raleigh, your beer's here. Do you want to have one with me?" And I really, like, within me, they prepared me for this moment in the psychiatric hospital, right? And I had a plan. I had, like, you know, triage, three things I'm supposed to do, people I'm supposed to call. Like, all this is running through my head in half a second. Along with the fact that, like, literally, like, I mean, not 4 days earlier, I was being held down by four people in a blanket on me so that I could be reborn in the universe by struggling out of the blanket. And, you know, like, that was my, oh, I'm free, you know? And I'm remembering this in a second, split second. And what I said, what I should have said is, "Do you understand? I'm on more psychiatric medicine than a kid should be on. They told me not to drink. I just got out of the psych ward. I don't want to drink with you. I don't want to be like an old man." And what I said was, "Yeah." You know, and I said, "Yeah." And I said, "Yeah," because I had all that stuff going on inside of me that if you knew, you have going on you right now. And it's like everything in me is tight. Everything is wound up. Everything is wrenched within me. It's like there's gnats flying around in my head. There, you know, it's not anything's terrible, but it's not good. It's like I'm kind of hungry. I'm not hungry. Everything's just there. And it's like, I don't know what to say to her. I don't know how to be. But somehow what I said was, yeah. Okay, now I didn't know what was going to happen. I had no more idea what alcohol did to me that night than I would heroin, which I've never, I had no idea what it would do for me. But I got that beer and I drank it with her, and then nothing really happened than I thought. And so I had another beer because I'm no quitter, you know? And, you know, I had another beer, and at some point the basement seemed really small. And why am I in the basement? Ashley went back upstairs. She needs to see me. So I grabbed another beer and went upstairs to see Ashley. You know, and I'm looking for her, and some kid looked at me and they said something smart, and I said something smart back, and then we got into this verbal exchange, and apparently I was very funny. This is hearsay. I don't remember this. I was told this on Monday morning at school, and the next thing you know, I have a couple of kids sitting there, and we're explaining what, you know, all about the psych ward. I'm telling about the level system, and they're laughing apparently, and you know, and but it's like, you know, and I really, you know, I don't know, because I blacked out at some point in the night. I woke up the next morning in my home, vomit on the bed, same clothes on, go downstairs and get yelled at by my mom, who's saying, you're just like your dad. And I'm like embarrassed, ashamed. I can't believe that I did it. I wasn't going to drink. You know I shouldn't drink. Here I am recreating this trouble for my mom. And I really felt devastated. I'm done. I'm glad I learned my lesson until Monday morning when I went to school. And then people were telling me stories about how funny I was. And how good it was to see me relax. And I was starting to remember what it felt like. Just that little relief that I got. Because I remembered that I was all wound up tight. Then all of a sudden I took a drink and just kind of all relaxed. And see, I didn't know what alcohol did for me. Alcohol did more for me in that 30 seconds to 30 minutes after I had my first beer than all the Gestalt therapy, all the psychiatric medication, any wrestling pen I ever got, any trumpet solo I ever nailed. It flipped some kind of a switch in my head, said, I don't care. I don't care that I just came out of a psych ward. I don't care about that crazy family I just came from. I don't care about what you think about me or what you think about me. I don't care who you think I should be, because if I can just get that in me, now I'm just like you. For the first time, I'm like you. I'm not better than you. I'm not drinking to get drunk. I'm drinking because it reduces the space between you and me and makes it acceptable so that I can actually just listen to you. It's like going into a bar sober, you know? It's dirty, it's dank, the music's too loud, the lights are too bright, the people are unattractive. You know, why am I here? And then I take a couple of drinks just to be social, you know? I don't want to, you know, I'm in the bar, I might as well have a drink. And I have the drink of alcohol, and something happens along the way where the lights get turned down, the music gets better, the conversation gets good, and the people around me become more attractive. Until the guy that I'm sitting next to, I couldn't stand, is my new business partner. And we're going to be starting a new adventure together. And then I can't wait to go talk to her. And it's just like it was when I was a kid again. See, that's what alcohol did for me. Alcohol did something really special for me. That when life got too hard and I needed some relief, alcohol was there. So you can understand how I was confused when I'm like sitting in an AA meeting and somebody's telling me alcohol is my problem. Because, see, I'm not relating to that. I'm sitting in a meeting, and, yeah, I had an issue. Something happened. I get it. Yeah, I lost control. I'm sorry. It won't happen again. I'll control myself better next time. But I go to AA meetings, and somebody up here is speaking, and they're like, alcohol's my problem. I stopped drinking. I put the plug in the jug, and now everything's great. And I go, God, I mean, I wish that was my problem. I wish I was an alcoholic. So all I had to do was stop drinking and my life would get better. But see, it doesn't get better for me. See, I didn't understand this until December 10th when I got sober, and December 31st, which I'll talk about in a minute. But December 10th, 2000, when I came back to AA, it had been a long stretch between my first AA meeting and that one. And I'd gone through all of the stages that somebody goes to when they first go to AA, I guess, if you do it like I did it. I went to the psychiatric hospital, I got exposed to it. And literally, I remember sitting there, it wasn't that I didn't like the people in AA, don't get me wrong, I liked the people. I related to some of the stories, I related to what they're talking about, just like when I was a kid. Like, I could go to, you know, any meeting, they took us to meetings, NA meetings, Narcotics Anonymous, AA meetings, Alcoholics Anonymous, which you're in or new, you know, CA meetings, you know, all GA meetings, any meeting, codependence, ACOA. We were at all these meetings at night because they needed something to do with the kids from 7:30 to 8:30 at night. And in the psychiatric hospital, they always meetings that were brought in. And even then, I remember thinking, which I thought all the way until I finally got sober here with you guys, that if I understand what the 12-step programs are, you have a problem, it gets bad, you figure out it's bad, you come here, and you stop doing whatever got you in trouble. And it's like a group therapy, like I had in psych ward. And then by not doing that a day at a time, life somehow gets better for you. It just gets better because you hadn't drinking a lot. The longer you go that drinking, the better it gets for you. And I bought into that. Yeah, I mean, I watched people. I had friends of mine that got sober. So I'm like, yeah, it must work. But the problem was I would sit in the meetings and I was fine. You know, I was fine the first 5 days, 10 days, 20 days. But something happened, certain period that I, you know, whatever the consequence was that drove me into AA, all of a sudden seemed not as bad. And then I'm sitting in the AA meeting and I'm listening to somebody like me in a suit up here talking. I'm relating out. He's talking about drinking problems, you know, he goes to AA, he has a sponsor, he does all these things, he's getting better. And I'm sitting in the back, and what happens is each Sunday night when I would come to this group, if I was coming to this group, I would feel like I was getting worse. I would start to feel like, I don't know where I want to be, but I don't want to be here. I would start to be irritated by the comments and what people were saying, and that they weren't really speaking to me anymore the way they seemed to be the first couple of weeks when I was getting sober. And then I was just kind of like, I don't know, I couldn't sit still. Like, you people are stationary. I couldn't be stationary. There was like a whole lot of movement. I had a cup of coffee going. I was, you know, whatever was happening, adjusting my clock. I didn't want to be here. And so I would say, and somebody would ask me how I was doing. I'm coming undone. I'm like, fine. Aren't you good? Feel good? Glad I'm at the meeting. But I'm dying inside. I go home and I start thinking, this ain't it either. God, I thought that last consequence I had. I thought when I came to at the corner, a busy intersection of Richmond, Virginia, with a knock on my window and a police officer sitting there with a flashlight, and he's knocking on the window and he's asking me why I was there. Am I okay? Should they call an ambulance? And I'm covered in my own bodily fluids because I drank so much I passed out and drove my car and stopped at the middle of an intersection. You know, and I say, I got to stop. And I come to AA and I stop drinking. I go to the meetings. And then I feel better. Finally, it's happened. I finally hit the bottom. Or no, maybe it's the time that I came home for Thanksgiving and I was just going to go out and have a drink with my friend. And I came in at 4 o'clock on Thanksgiving Day so drunk I couldn't stand up and went upstairs to take a nap and miss Thanksgiving dinner. And then that wasn't the problem. The problem is the next morning where everyone is no longer even yelling at me. They're just tolerating me. They don't even want to have conversations with me anymore. Or the time where it gets so bad that I come home and I knock on the door and my mom answers and she says, I'm sorry, you can't come in here. I can't let you in my home anymore. You know, or no, maybe it was the time that I joined the Marine Corps because that was going to save me because I can't, drinking's not the issue. Maybe it's discipline. Maybe it's no respect. I'm going to go get that uniform that my uncle wore. You know, maybe it was the time I disrespected that uniform by doing things in that uniform that I should have gotten kicked out for. And having some kind of phony credibility because of a set of clothes I wore and I couldn't hold up to the ideals that I swore to do. Maybe that was the one that was going to get me sober. Or no, maybe it was this one. Maybe it was when another night at the club in 1999 where I'm just driving home and tonight, you know, I can't believe I did it again. You know, I did it. I punched my friend. I broke his rib. I wasn't even thinking to do it. And I go home and I'm trying to go to sleep and pass out, but I don't have any alcohol in the house. And I had one of those like cheap apartments where they have those real thin blinds and it's Sunday morning and the light's bright and it's coming in and I can't make it dark enough and I can't go to sleep and I can't stop thinking. And so I finally just moved my pillows and slept in the bathtub because that was the only room in the house that could get dark enough for me to not have to feel. And I come into AA and me coming into AA was like somebody trying to lose weight by stopping eating. You know, every day I got hungrier and hungrier and hungrier and hungrier until before you know it, I'm willing to do anything just to get a bite of food. And then so I eat. And my eating was alcohol. Because the alcohol always worked for me. Always. Now the consequences got more and more. But here's what would happen. Alcohol has a definitive benefit over Alcoholics Anonymous, which is it works its maximum potential 30 seconds to a couple minutes. And if I get really tight tonight and my life gets to the place where I need a drink and I take a drink of alcohol, it'll do just what it did when I was that age. And that's what I'll get tonight. But here's the problem. See, that's only the first part of what my issue is because I didn't know this. But what happened on December 10th, 2000, I woke up. I had another bottom that I hit. I won't talk about it tonight, but I crossed another moral line. It was something I couldn't believe I'd done. It was something, I'd already been alienating my family. I wasn't allowed to go home anymore. I told you about that. I wasn't allowed to call my uncle. I owed him money. I never paid him back. My sister was tired of taking calls from me. I had broken trust with my boss. I'd crossed another line that night. I'd woken up and I'd hit bottom. And if you're new and you're hoping you're going to find some places bad enough to hit bottom, I just gave you 5 reasons that I should stop. I should have been able to stop drinking, but I couldn't. So what was different that time and this time? What was different from all those 5 times at this time? Because it wasn't the worst drunk I'd ever had. It was another consequence. But what I came to understand is that a bottom is just a temporary condition where my circumstances of living change quicker than I can lower my own standards. So for just a moment in time, it's intolerable to me. But I can tell you this, my first bottom looked like a good day compared to my last bottom. Because over time, the wheels of alcoholism, they might grind slowly, but over time, they will take everything you love in your life. And there's an old speaker named Norm A, and he would talk about that. He would say that it would finally take everything in your life, and then they knock on the door one day, and they come and get it, and what is it? It's your self-respect. And an alcoholic that doesn't even have any self-respect is a dangerous thing. And see, I didn't come to AA desperate. I came to AA desperate a lot of times before 2000. But see, desperation implies AA is one of the things I'm trying to use. I've got my group therapy. I've got my level system. I've got the Marine Corps. I've got my uniform. I've got my girlfriend. Those are going to help me. AA is going to kind of supplement that. So I'm desperate, maybe. I came here hopeless. I didn't even think Alcoholics Anonymous would work for me. See, I used to sit in the back of the rooms and sit in the bars, and I hear somebody in AA, and I'd be very, it was a weird thing, the response. I'd be so proud of them. My God, that's great. Good for you. But see, I had something that was wrong that you didn't understand. This is what I was trying to explain to the guy on December 31st who took me to meet my first sponsor. I was trying to explain to him that I'm not an alcoholic. You understand? Because see, I have 3 things. I have 1, I have a mind that alcohol works for. The problem is when I drink it, people think I'm trying to get drunk. I'm not trying to get drunk. I'm just trying to get the relaxation. I'm just trying to get there. But there moves. Sometimes there was 5 drinks. Sometimes I was drinking all night, but I needed to get to that place where I could breathe. But see, the problem is when I tried to get to that place just where I could breathe, I try to maintain it. But the problem is it was like a law of diminishing returns. And over time, what I had to do to get to where I could get the relief grew. And so I was passing out before I got the relief. But every once in a while it worked. And every once in a while it was better than what you had to offer me here. Because here it was, I'm no solution. I'm sitting in the back of the room drinking coffee, you know, and I'm not getting better. Because I'm not drinking. And I'm sitting in the middle of this. So the first thing was that I had to like alcohol and the effect that it had on me. I knew that. But see, the second thing that I had was that when I drink alcohol, I couldn't do it safely. I knew that. But I knew that I couldn't drink safely. When I put alcohol in my system, I could not tell you what I was going to do next. That was a problem. But I had a mind that I wouldn't quit. I had a body that wouldn't die. And I had a personality that just would not work for a guy like me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that. And so that thought that this AA thing would not work for a guy like me. And so when I came here, I was completely hopeless because I didn't even think AA would work for me anymore. I didn't think I had any hope at all. And finally, what I came to find out is that's the only time it can. It's the only time AA can work is when I have nothing left to say. You want me, whatever you want me to do. So December 10th, I got sober. By December 31st, I was bored. I went to a meeting. It was a morning meeting. It was at a men's home. My plan that night was to go to a New Year's Eve party at a bar to meet some old friends out there, but I wasn't going to drink. That was my plan. And newcomer, if you're new, you got a plan. I had a plan. That was my plan. I was going to get on my feet, get another job, figure things out, patch things up with the boss. Things are going to be good. We're going to get back in the game, and now I'm going to be back on top again, right? That's the problem with alcoholism, is that I tear down the walls and tear down the structure, and I rebuild it again, and I tear it down, and I build it up, and I tear it down, and I build it up. And the only problem is, the longer I go, the shorter the periods of relief are, and the bigger the job is to reconstruct it. But I came in there, and I met this guy. He was a young guy there, and I couldn't believe this guy was there. He's like my age. I was 26 at the time. And the guy was like, "Hey, you look like you know." And I was like, "I have 21 days. Like, don't ever like correct a guy on day count on the wrong day. He will correct you in heartbeat." TJ talked about that, you know. And so you got to be careful with that. But he said, "Okay, so you've been around A before?" I said, "Oh yeah, I've been in and out for like 10 years. Like it's some badge of honor, you know. But I've been in and out for like 10 years, you know." And he's like, "Really?" Now I'm going to sum this up, but this is what a 2-hour conversation kind of distilled down to. But it was like, "Really? You've been in and out of AA?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, I've been in and out for like 10 years. He said, "Let me ask you a question." He said, "You ever work all 12 steps in their entirety?" And I said, "Well, you know, I got to a fifth step." He said, "That's a yes or no question." And I was like, "No, technically, if you phrase it like that, I never technically got through all 12 steps." And I was like, "Well, then," he said, "well, I guess you never took another man through the 12 steps." I said, "No, I never took." He said, "Then let me tell you something. You've never been in AA. You're just a visitor." He said, "You're the guy in the back of the room drinking the coffee, trying to date our women, and you think you're NAA. You're like a guy going to the Bears game, sitting in the bleachers, waiting to get called on the field. You're not even wearing a jersey, much less have the skill or the ability to be pulled on there, and if you did, you wouldn't know what to do." He said, "You're not in the game." He said, "Going to the let's assume going to the meeting is like a football game, then you're at the huddle at the meeting. Can you imagine a game full of huddles? It'd be the most boring football game ever. This is not AA. This is an AA meeting. AA meeting is where we go and learn how to do the things we do from 8:30 tonight to the next meeting we go to. What play are we going to run? How are we going to do it out there? How do I live a day at a time in a world I never belonged in without alcohol?" See, if AA is about not drinking, then you got more than 5 days sober. We got nothing to offer you. You're sober. You can't get any more sober than sober. You're detoxed, okay? But if you're like me, you got a bigger problem, which is I don't know how to live a day at a time without a drink of alcohol in my system because I need a drink. See, what I said when I started is I needed a drink long before I took one. And if I ever leave AA, it'll be because I needed a drink long before I took one. So if you're new, there's a couple things. One is this. If you don't work the first 9 steps in their entirety, my experience is it's not if you're going to drink, it's when. On what day and what time does God's grace expire? Or what time and what place does it get so bad that you finally have to drink, not because you're crazy, but to preserve your sanity? Those first 9 steps, there's nothing ego-filling about them. I got a sponsor who's an ego-terrorist. He just tore me to pieces, like what I was talking to TJ about. I was trained by experts, man. You're not in luck. And what they did is they had me do things that I would never do before, never even think about doing. But he said, "Look, I'm going to be your sponsor. Here's what I want you to do. I'm going to ask you to do some things. I'll never ask you to do anything that's illegal, immoral, or indecent, but you have to be willing to follow direction. Can you do that?" And I said, "Well, but that's a yes or no question." I'm like, "Fine, this guy is like really aggressive, you know?" "Fine, yes, I lied. I can follow direction, okay?" So I start following his direction. I go around, I meet other people, but I didn't learn this reading it in a book. This is in a Hazelden workshop. It's not about fill out my book and who gets an A on the test graduates. It's I don't know how to live with my life. What do I do when I get a job sober? What do I do when I get fired sober? I've been fired sober when it wasn't my fault. What do I do when they're gossip about? What do I do about that mother that I'm not allowed to go home to? How do I deal with that? What do I do to repair these relationships? What do I do about the 3 a.m.s when I'm sober again and I'm just like I was when I was in that little apartment with those blinds and I can't make them shut, but I'm a year sober and I don't know how to tell somebody that because they're going to kick me out of here. Because see, I think I have a drinking problem. What I have is alcoholism. And alcoholism, one of the ways I can cure it is to drink alcohol. I have a spiritual malady and it's treated with the spirit. When I drink it, it does the trick. But if I can no longer live with that because that solution's killing me, then what do I do? How do I live? I don't know how to live. And it's not about filling out a workbook. It's not about doing checkboxes. That's checkbox sobriety that won't keep you sober. So what does that look like? I'll give you a quick snapshot. I'll tell you a story because that's what time for one story. So over the years, I got to make amends to a lot of people, and I obtained time to make amends to my mom, and I was not allowed to make amends to her for my first several years sober. They said, "You've been telling her sorry for all of your life." So I would go home, and I would clean up. I would put the fans up. I would paint a room. I would move a bush. I would plant her garden. And over the years, I'd bring guys that I sponsor over, and they get to meet them. They get to meet my mom. It's interesting. And I went over that time. Now, I didn't bring you through all this, but I ended up in foster care, ended up on the streets. I ended up in a lot of places, and her and I did not have a relationship. But at a certain point, what started to happen is I started to tolerate her, then I started to like her, then I started to appreciate her, and then I began to admire her. And somewhere along that line, we started to restore this relationship. And somewhere along this line, I'd started to be her son again. I didn't even know what had happened. But one Christmas, we're sitting there, and this is in 2010. I didn't have any girls date, and I couldn't bring anybody home. There was nowhere to hide. And so it was just me and my mom, and we sat there on Christmas. We opened a present before Christmas Eve, which we did. And we opened this little present. And it was like just for a minute, just me and my mom and the Christmas tree, I felt like I had that mom feeling. You know that feeling? Like I'm safe. You're okay. Now it passed again. She started annoying me like 5 seconds later. But it was there. Now, something miraculous happened. She started getting sick. She had COPD, emphysema, diabetes, bad heart. She started getting really sick and started getting called home a lot. And finally, in November of 2011, I got called home the last time. And I went down there and my mom pulled us to the bedside and she said, I can't do this anymore. I can't continue to, like, she kept getting intubated. That's putting in your lungs and all that. And she said, I can't live like this anymore. She said, I don't want to be resuscitated again. And she said, Raleigh, I want you to be on the living will. I wasn't allowed in her house. And then I was allowed on her will. The one that says she doesn't want to be resuscitated. He said, because your sister can't handle it. So when she died, I was there in the room next to her. I wasn't on a bar stool somewhere talking about how my mom was dying. There was nothing left to say between us. Just to say hello. And I don't have any regret in that relationship anymore. You guys taught me how to live like that a day at a time. I didn't read in the book. I did it by watching you and doing what you did. Thanks.
First of all, I want to thank all of the facilitators, leaders of the workshops. It was such an honor and such a pleasure to work with you. And from what I've heard, you've done an amazing job. So thank you very much. It has been my honor to be the speakers and workshops for AZ Spring Break. I take this service really seriously. And the title of today's talk, if I were to give it, is A Modicum of Our Mustard Seed of Faith. We have to clean up the wreckage of our past. I've known the speaker for quite a while. He was my sponsor in another program. And in the last, couple years, he's had to practice these principles in all of his affairs in a very inspiring way. And so I am completely humbled to introduce our speaker today, Chris. Grateful alcoholic. I want to thank the committee and David for asking me to speak today. It's quite an honor. I've served on spring break before. I know what an incredibly difficult job it is. So thank you for that. It's been a wonderful weekend. I also, before I get started on Experience, Strength, and Hope, want to note the passing of Father Larry Dolan, who passed away this week. Father Larry came to many spring breaks. He was very important to me, especially in my early sobriety. And his memorial service is 7 p.m. on Tuesday at the Franciscan Renewal Center, if you're interested in attending that. So I'm grateful that there are some newcomers here. The only thing I think that separates newcomers from myself is that I have a tiny bit more experience, strength, and hope to share. I certainly don't recommend the path I have been on to get to where I am today, so please don't follow in my footsteps at all. I met with my sponsor, I guess it'll be almost 2 weeks ago, and she's here today. And I said, I'm a little nervous about speaking at spring break. And she said, why? And I said, well, because I want to be perfect. And she said, well, what are you going to do about that? I'm like, the weekend before, I'm going to practice, and I'm going to write it out, and I'm going to get it all, under control. And she's like, no, you're not going to do that. And I'm like, what do you mean I'm not going to do that? And she's like, if you can't let God speak through you, then you're not being of service. So I hope God has something exciting to say because I didn't prep that much at all. My sobriety date is March 24th, 2006. I'm very grateful to have not had a relapse. I'm very grateful that I've been sober since that time. But to give you a little bit of background, I come from an alcoholic home. My father is one of 12 children. It's up to them to diagnose if they're an alcoholic, but definitely 11 of them had issues with alcohol. So it was very prevalent on my father's side of the family. And the same with my mother's side of the family. My grandfather was an alcoholic. My grandmother found her father hanging in the barn. He had committed suicide by hanging, and that was due to alcohol use also. He was a notorious drunk. So I was certainly surrounded by a lot of ism growing up between the alcoholism and the untreated Al-Anonism in my life. And what that really taught me was that there's a lot of secrets. You can't function, or I couldn't function, in that family without having secrets. One of the secrets that I had, in addition to having relatives that were, you know, seemingly constantly in trouble that we couldn't talk about, was that I was molested from a really young age by my aunt. And until I came into program and I heard another gay man who had been molested by a female, I wasn't sure that this was the program for me. And when I heard that, I was like, okay, you know, maybe I'm not as unique as I thought I was. The other thing I knew at a young age, and I kept that a secret, I didn't tell anyone until I was much older, what had happened with her. The other thing I kept a secret is that I knew at a young age that I was gay. So I lived in a small town in Pennsylvania. It was a different time. Being gay was absolutely not acceptable in my family. It definitely felt like it was a secret that I had to keep. Yet oddly, it was a secret that I think my father knew. My father wanted the varsity football player son. That was not me at all. Or wrestling, or basketball. I chose the country club sports, tennis and swimming. And he hardly ever came to those, but I'm sure if I had been in football or wrestling, he would have went all the time. My father never was physically abusive. He was just emotionally abusive, which, you know, carries its own scars. And so childhood was kind of rough, say, is an understatement. Because my father was so abusive when he was drinking, I didn't want to drink alcohol. I never wanted to be like my father. I never drank in high school. Until I was 16, I went and spent a month in France. And my host family had a birthday party. And I was served a glass of champagne. And I thought, well, this is the type of drinking I could do. You know, we're at a party, it's, you know, Paris, it's champagne. It seemed like that was, you know, what this little gay boy wanted. And I didn't, you know, I think I had two glasses of champagne. And that was it. So I didn't drink again until I graduated high school. But from the time I graduated high school and the drinking started, all through college and grad school, I drank alcoholically right from the beginning. There was never a time where I had controlled drinking, whatever that is. I don't know what that is. I definitely drank alcoholically. It was definitely a problem. But at the time, I was very high functioning. You know, I finished my education. Like any good gay boy from Pennsylvania, I moved to San Francisco, and that didn't make the drinking go down. It made the drinking go up. And I started seeing a therapist, and the therapist tried to put me on a learning method of controlled drinking. So I would go and, you know, read the stuff he gave me, and then I would come back a week later at $150 a pop and lie and say, oh yeah, that's really working. It didn't work for me at all. So, you know, in 1995, I met my now husband in San Francisco, and I knew shortly after that that drinking was going to prevent that relationship from moving forward. So I quit drinking. And that this is an AA meeting, so I will tell you that other substances play a big role in my story, especially getting to the bottom. But all of those substances were a substitute for alcohol. Alcohol was my love. It prevented me from thinking negative thoughts about myself for the beginning, and then I would certainly think about negative things after that. And it really helped achieve what I wanted to achieve, which was that there's definitely something wrong with me. If that wasn't the case, then I wouldn't have been molested. My father would have treated me he treated all the other sons in the neighborhood. And alcohol and other substances really helped soothe that. So even though I wasn't at all sober, I didn't drink for almost 10 years. And in that period of time, if people, we'd be out or something, and they'd say, well, why aren't you drinking? And I'd be like, well, I'm an alcoholic. And they're like, do you go to those meetings? I'm like, I'm not that type of alcoholic. like, no way. But I wasn't at all what you would call sober. I was doing other things. So those other things progressed, and it got to the point where I moved from San Francisco to Southern California, and my partner moved eventually with me, and I could no longer afford those other mind-altering substances. So in order to continue with the habit that I had at that point, I started selling them. And I am not the type of person who does anything small. I'm really a high achiever. And so I thought, you know, I have an MBA. I'm going to bring this to that market, and I'm going to make a difference. And I did. I was very successful. And one day, I wasn't at home. And my business partner and my now husband were in that house, and the DEA and the U.S. Marshals raided the house. And I called my sister. So my sister was a paralegal. And it made national news because John Ashcroft, who was the Attorney General at the time, did the press release for it himself. And even though I wasn't mentioned by name, the case was definitely all over the news for a couple of days. And my sister said, oh, and right before that, I had went to my sister's for, earlier in the year, I went to my sister's, and I had two cell phones. And honestly, I had two cell phones because one, I needed one for work, that job. And the other one was that I didn't, you know, back then you couldn't transfer your contacts very easily, so I was kind of carrying two phones around. And when she took me back to the airport, she said, are you selling something? And I'm like, yes, but I know what I'm doing. I have an exit plan. And it's not going to last much longer. So when I called her, she wasn't at all surprised. And she says, you're facing 20 years. I looked it up. And I'm like, I'm not going to prison for 20 years. That's not going to happen. And so I became a fugitive. And, you know, that's a very lengthy story. I would tell you that the highlights of it were I went from hotel to hotel in Southern California. I dyed my hair. I got glasses. I grew a goatee. There's a immigration checkpoint on the highway from San Diego to Los Angeles. I didn't know how to get past it. I had rented a car before. I thought that they were going to track my credit cards. It was slightly different back then. And I went to the closest mall and exchanged the license plates. So I had the car, but I didn't think I could drive it past the immigration checkpoint. So I rented a limo and sat in the limo and had a pocket knife. And I was going to slit my throat, I thought, if we were stopped at immigration. But of course, you know, they don't really stop limousines. some people think that I escaped that part of my life with this gargantuan amount of money. And that is not the case. I think I had like $5,000 on me, which, you know, was enough at the time to get to where I was going. And where I was going was Northern California. About 2 weeks before that incident, I had said to my partner that, you know, I needed to get sober. This wasn't working. I was never to get to the financial goal I wanted. Life was absolutely miserable. And some friends had brought him to the hotel I was staying before I left Southern California. And we agreed to meet in Northern California. So I made my way there. It involved the limo. It involved overhearing someone at a Starbucks in downtown Los Angeles say they were driving to San Francisco. They ended up driving me to San Francisco. And I got up to San Francisco. I stayed in an unusually large number of hotels without ID. I think it's because I'm white. I don't know. Certainly it was very strange because you can't really do that today. And no credit cards. And I eventually made it to my father-in-law's in Northern California. I threw all my stuff over the fence, waited for him to get home. And he had heard what happened. And he's like, well, you can't stay here. I was like, no, I don't. And he's like, but I'll feed you dinner. So we had dinner. And then he dropped me off. And I went to Guerneville, California. If you're not familiar with that, it's this little gay enclave in the Russian River. And it was off season, so I was able to get a cabin. And I thought, okay, I'm set. Well, you know, $5,000 when you're renting limos and everything else doesn't really last very long. So the money became an issue. Living there became an issue. You know, my husband went to my father-in-law's, and we decided that we were going to move. And you know, ended up stealing money from my father-in-law to do it. And we eventually made our way to Phoenix, and it was very problematic. And in this time, so the raid happened at the end of September, and we moved here in January, and I hadn't had any drugs or alcohol whatsoever. So we get an apartment here, which was really not that difficult. And one day he was pouring a drink, and I thought, God, it's been 10 years. I must be cured by now, because that other substances thing was so bad that going back to alcohol seems like that's a great idea. And you know, that's the type of decision making that that I had. And so I had a drink, and within 2 weeks was drinking alcoholically. And in that 2 week period, it was very white knuckle, trying to control it. And then I was off to the races again. So you know, we lived in, you know, not that great of places. It's hard when you don't have references, you don't have a job. So we had roommates. It was bad, really terrible living situations usually. And drinking. So we ended up both getting jobs. And one day, after a drunk that was really no different than any other drunk I had every day, I woke up and I was sick. I was sick and tired of having my soul be not even recognizable. The type of person that I had become was just not the type of person I wanted to be. I was so sick that day that I did not go to AA. But I called central office and I said, well, where is there a gay meeting? And they told me about Lambda. And so I think I called on Sunday or Monday. And I was there the next night at Lambda. And I met a lot of people that are in this room today, for which I'm very grateful for. And all those people set an example for me that took quite a while to learn, but taught me what I needed to know. And what I needed to know was that even though I had an immense amount of fear, that there was a spiritual solution to that fear. Unfortunately, it took a while to learn that. So on December 8th, 2015, I got a phone call. And in that period of time, I had bought a business, which is a whole other weird thing as a made-up name and everything else, how that happened. And it was very successful. And I got a call from the IRS, and they said, so we noticed that your LLC has not filed any tax returns. And so I'm, you know, is my business, is accounting, and I'm Googling that phone number. And it comes up and says, well, the IRS doesn't call you. If you get a call from this number, it's a scam. So I say to her, oh, this is a scam. I'm going to hang up now. She's like, I'll send you a letter. And I'm like, okay. So I get this letter, and I was like, oh, shit. Like, it didn't occur to me that this was the time. I thought, how am I going to get out of this? And so because I was in accounting, I knew a lot of tax attorneys. So I went to this woman I'd used for my clients, and I slid a dollar across the table, and I said, I have something to tell you. And she's like, what is that? And she slides the dollar back. She's like, you don't need that for attorney privilege. I'm like, are you sure? And I said, so I've been a fugitive for almost 14 years, and I got this letter from the IRS, and I slide the letter over, and she's like, what? Well, yeah, so I'm a fugitive, and I get this letter. I need to know how to fix this, so, you know, I continue being a a fugitive. And because it doesn't occur to me, even though I've been in program for 10 years and worked the steps with my sponsor over and over, that this was the time. And so she's like, oh my God, I don't know. I can't help you, and you need to come back tomorrow. And I was like, oh, sure. So I went back the next day, and I met with my now attorney and told him the whole story. And he's like, wow. He's like, that's something. And I said, so how do I fix it? And he's like, oh, there's no fixing this. You need to resolve what happened to you in 2002. And if you're not interested in doing that, then you need to find another attorney. And I'm like, well, that seems awfully harsh. Like, my business is going really well. You know, I'm with my husband. We've got a lot of friends. And so I went home, and I told my husband, well, this is what they think should happen. And I said, you know, we need to talk about this. I said, you know, the one option would be to do it over again. And, you know, we have a dear friend who we're very close to, and I knew that she would scour the earth until she relocated me. So I knew that probably wasn't going to work. Clearly, suicide was not a viable option. And I said, well, you know what? Let's sleep on it. So I got up really early the next day, and I felt this incredible sense of peace, like a peace that I had never felt before. And I was like, oh, my God, this is it. I am ready to do this, and I'm ready to do this because I spent 10 years with a lot of people in this room who showed me how to do it. So I went back to my attorney that day, and I said, okay, I'm ready. And so they were unable to find another fugitive who lived in the United States for so long that turned themselves in, so there was no game plan. They didn't know what to do or how to handle it. I had the business, so I needed to sell the business, which was great because they were expensive. And I think if I hadn't had private attorneys, the outcome would have been much different. And this next part is important to my recovery. So I'm not saying this to throw anyone under the bus. But one of the first people that I told was my AA sponsor. And at first, that went really well. I'm like, look, I'm making... And how I framed this with the attorneys once I went back that day, with everybody I knew, was that I have this amends to make, and I need to do it. So I met with my sponsor because I didn't know how to do this amends. 10 days later, met with my sponsor, and it ended with, I don't know who you are, you're not making an amends, and I never want to speak to you again. And I've never spoken to my sponsor again. And that was devastating to me because I thought that after all the time we've been together, that eventually I knew that this day would come, and I always expected my sponsor to be there with me. So that was very difficult. But luckily, there are people in this room today that I met with that I said, look, am I making an amends? I'm thrown now because if I'm not making amends, then I'm getting ready to turn myself in for no reason. I was definitely making my amends. So it took 3 months to sell the business and to train the buyer. And my attorneys had set a deadline that was coincided with the closing of the business. I was ready to go. This was a Monday. So I can't memorize anything. I'm too stressed out. So I wrote in Sharpie on my arm phone numbers, and I'm waiting. Shaved my hair. I don't know why I'm shaving. And nothing happens. So the attorneys all this time are meeting with a federal prosecutor, you can't enter a federal building without ID. I didn't have ID, so they were trying to work out all these details. So I didn't know that Sharpie wears off. So the next morning, I'm doing the Sharpie again, and I'm ready to go, and nothing happens. So this happens every day for a week. It's very stressful. So on Friday, my attorney calls and says, well, nothing's going to happen over the weekend. So I went to, and in this length of time from even when I made the decision in December, I didn't turn myself in until March. I went to a ton of meetings. I shared at every meeting what was going on. I didn't give like real specifics about it, so you know my attorneys were freaking out that I was even saying anything. But I shared with a lot of people, and it also gave me a time period in which I could make amends to everyone I needed to make amends to, which there are still amends to make in that area. I'm grateful that because I do lie well, I'm an alcoholic, but that I told the truth about everything except my name and this one part of my life. So at least I didn't have to, you know, correct a bunch of other things. But still, it was bad, and it was emotionally difficult to have those conversations with people. One of the reasons I think that I waited so long was that in recovery we get this family, a family that I had really come to love. And I can remember so many times thinking, God, if you really knew who I was and that I lied to you for this long, you're going to hate me. And that ended up not being the case. Everyone responded with a lot of love and understanding, except that one person. And so that was great. And so on Monday of the following week, so it's been a week now that I'm ready to turn myself in, my attorney calls and says, well, I have good news. It's tomorrow. And I'm like, is that the good news? And he's like, and I think you're going to be free during the plea negotiation. And I'm like, first of all, I was like, free? You made me sell my business at a loss, and now you're saying I'm going to be free for another 6 or 7 months? I said, but, you know, that's better than prison. Okay. So he's like, but we're not going to be sure until we get there. So they had arranged with the prosecutor and the marshals to meet me in the front of the federal building. I went down that morning. I was scared to death. Had no idea what was going to happen. I didn't know if I was going to go home that day or not. And you're processed. You're strip searched. You know, the whole nine yards. I'm in cuffs. I'm, you know, DNA fingerprinted. And put in a holding cell where I was the only person in a suit. And I sat there, and I lost track of time. I knew my court hearing was at 3, and I thought for sure it was at least 4. When they came and got me, it was like 2:30. And we went up to court, and long story short, I went home that night with my attorney with an ankle monitor on. And from that period until sentencing, my legal experience could not have went better. I approached this as an amends. And so when I open the door for amends, that means I have to accept whatever's going to happen next. One of the people I made amends to in that period was my father. So in the work I had done with my first sponsor, I had worked on forgiving my aunt for the molestation. Forgiving the dead, I have to tell you, is easier, I think, than the living. My father was living, so that was a little harder. But in the period of time before I could really communicate with him, I sent him a letter. And I'm really glad that I did that. I had not spoken to him for 14 years. And when I was finally able to speak to him, I found out that he got sober 7 years before me. And I cried on the phone. He made his amends to me. I made my amends to him. And I kept that door open. I speak to my father, you know, not that often, but at least a couple times a month we now speak. So the hardest part of the legal situation was, you know, the press was really bad at the time, and because I had fled, all the other people pointed at me and, you know, said things about me that weren't true, and so I was facing a 10-year mandatory minimum sentence. And I knew that. I knew that right from the get-go. My attorney and I flew to Detroit, the case was out of Detroit, and met with the DEA agent who was still working for the DEA and the prosecutor. And I told them my story. And after that meeting, I was supposed to have a polygraph. So I meet with them, and they come back in the room after they walked out and met with themselves and said, well, we believe what you're saying, but the law is written so loosely regarding the mandatory minimum that you still qualify for that. I said, yes, I know. But I said, I wanted to tell you the truth. And he said, well, we don't have to go through the polygraph. We believe what you're saying. And I don't know if justice is served by giving you a 10-year mandatory minimum, but I'll think about it. And I was like, think about it. And so we flew back from Detroit. And that's the first time I had been on an airplane in 14 years. I also had not driven for 14 years, so I had to get my license back, which was fun. And so I get back, and about 2 weeks later, they sent the paperwork that showed that there was no mandatory minimum. So at that point, it could be anything from probation to something much more severe than that. So in that process, you know, I'm still going to a lot of meetings. I have a new sponsor. I'm working hard in program. It's the only thing that's keeping me sane. I'm talking to a lot of people about what's going on, and that really helped a lot too. Part of what happens before you negotiate your plea is a pretrial report. And in that process, the woman that did it, had said, I don't know what to recommend about this person for sentencing. He's living the type of life we want everyone to live after they've committed a crime. And yet she came with 36 months. Well, compared to 10 years, I was like, okay, 36 months. And then we got the sentencing judge, and the sentencing judge is a JAG attorney. JAG court, so he's a military judge as well, and he has a terrible reputation for harsh sentencing. And the prosecutor used to work in the same office with him, and my criminal defense attorney used to work in the same office with him, and they all said, this is bad news. And I thought, well, how do we get rid of this? And I can distinctly remember thinking, okay, I'm in program. I'm not supposed to, wish for harm for others. Maybe a mild heart attack. So my attorney said, well, the way to get rid of him is because this plea agreement that we did doesn't conform to Arizona. He's going to kick it in court, so you'll go back to Detroit and we'll finish up there, and here are all benefits to that. So I had this feeling when I went to court that this was the day, even though my attorney said no, it was not going to be the day. I get into court and the judge says, I don't know what to do with you. I've been up since 3 o'clock in the morning. And your pre-sentence report says you're living this wonderful life. You've got these great people that wrote in for you. You're living a great life. I'm afraid what would incarcerating you do to you at this point. And so we kind of went back and forth and talked and cried, and he sentenced me to 18 months. So in a drug case, you're remanded in custody at the time of sentencing. So I had a sponsee there, my husband was there, my friend that spoke for me was there. I was able to say goodbye, and I went downstairs and was shackled in a bus by 5 o'clock heading for Florence. And I can remember that the sun was setting on Camelback. And I'm doing the math about the sentence, and I'm like, oh my God, about a year from now, I'm gonna be back. And that's what happened. Prison was not a great experience, but it couldn't have been better for me. I was at a prison camp for most of it. There's no guards, hardly, there's no fences. There's really nothing to do. But there was an AA meeting there, for which I'm very grateful for. These two men each had over 40 years of sobriety and have been bringing AA into the prisons in the Tucson area for like 35 of those 40 years. So I never missed one of those meetings. I was able to walk someone through the steps. So that was fantastic. I had my sponsor visited me. My husband came down often. I had more, there's three federal prisons in Tucson. I had more mail than any other person in those three prisons, most of which is from my recovery family, for which I'm incredibly grateful for. So I get out, go through the halfway house experience. I'm not happy about that, but this is immense. You gotta do what you gotta do. And now all of that's over. I do have some probation. But the woman couldn't be nicer to me. She's just really lovely. I'm very lucky all the way around. In court, I signed a plea for 99 months. And to be sentenced for what I was sentenced and only be gone for less than a year was an amazing gift from God. What it did to my program was, and it's weird to say this, but I'm very grateful that incarceration was part of my sentence. He first was talking about probation. But if he had put me on probation, I wouldn't have learned spiritually what I needed to learn. I'm a big believer that the shit of life is the fertilizer for spiritual growth, and I needed to go through more shit before I could really get the growth that I wanted. And the growth that I wanted was, I wanted to live life on life's terms. I wanted to believe that my higher power had me no matter what, and that's exactly what happened. I believe that my higher power has a plan for me. I don't need to know what the plan is. I don't need to figure it out. I don't need to worry about it. I don't need to stress about it. Whatever happens, happens, and I'm so grateful for that. I knew a lot about program when I went because I'm a nerd. I read it all. I could pass a multiple choice or essay quiz on AA. But To know it emotionally or spiritually is absolutely totally different for me. I didn't learn those lessons until I went through more shit. And so the last 2 years has been both difficult but also incredible, incredible amount of spiritual growth that I got from that experience. I am both humble and grateful. I was not subjected to violence. It didn't matter at the camp that I was gay. I met some wonderful people. I mean, it really was not as bad. And now the biggest blessing is that I am happy, joyous, and free. I had not been happy, joyous, and free my entire life. Living in an alcoholic home is not happy, joyous, and free. Being an active alcoholic and whatever is not happy, joyous, and free. And when I got sober, I was 40 years old and a fugitive. That is not happy, joyous, and free. Now that I'm almost 52, it's happy, joyous, and free time. And I'm really super grateful for that. It's still sinking in. So there's a perspective on it that I still haven't quite got because it's, you know, I just was home full time 2 months ago. So, you know, it's still sinking in that I'm happy, joyous, and free. But, you know, I have people say, well, are you nervous about speaking today? And I was like, well, I was nervous about being perfect. But I wasn't nervous about speaking because after what I've been through, I can do anything. I'm absolutely positive about that. I can't say that I regret not doing this earlier, that I spent 10 years lying to people that I love was part of my journey, and I had to do it that way in order to get to where I needed to go. But certainly as I look back, you know, I would have avoided a little bit of wreckage had I been truthful with my sponsor from the beginning. So if you're new to program, if you have amends to make that you haven't made, nothing is as bad as we think it's going to be. It was not as bad for me as I thought it was going to be at all. It was difficult, it was hard, but you know, I can remember the first time going through the steps with my sponsor, she said, are you willing to go to any length to get it? And I lied right to her face and said yes. And I kept lying like that for years until I finally said yes. And it took what it took to get there. You know, today, I have a lot of love in my life. You know, I have a wonderful recovery program. I have wonderful people in this room I have known the entire time I've been sober. I've been very grateful for that. I got as involved as I could in service. So that whole experience has been really great, gave me a really good foundation. I don't recommend this, but AA really prepares you for prison. Really does, yeah. I was very calm in situations that used to baffle me for sure. And I'm so grateful. I'm really grateful for the people in these rooms. I would go to meetings and I would tell my story, and time again, people would just show me love. And that's what I really needed. I was so afraid that I was going to be judged and judged harshly. That has not been the case. And instead, I did what I needed to do to stay sober. I did what I needed to do so that my husband and I could have a normal life and my family. I did what I needed to do because the weight of all those events that I hadn't done was really too much to bear. And I don't know when I would have relapsed, but I would have relapsed. There's no doubt about it. I got stressed out. You know, there was a darkness in my soul I could not heal. I couldn't heal it till I had the sunlight of the Spirit. And sunlight in the Spirit for me was telling the truth. So I'm really grateful for David for asking me to speak today, and I'm really grateful for being here, and I'll pass.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging a dollar or two a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.